So how do you keep time? This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent. It always feels like there's just not enough time in the day. And why do so many of us feel this way? Are there different ways to deal with a clock that can help us find the time that we've been looking for? Does time always have to be running out, I guess? Well, our guests this hour have taken the time to investigate all of these questions and more. But I'd also like to hear from you about your relationship with that clock or how you manage it, or perhaps how it manages you. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 to join our conversation, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guests, Ian Bogost is a contributing writer for The Atlantic and a co-host of the podcast How to Keep Time. Ian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Ian's co-host, Rebecca Rashid, producer with The Atlantic. And Becca, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Ian, I'll start with what's the goal of this season's How to Keep Time podcast? What are you aiming for?
Well, I think part of the goal is philosophical. You know, what is time is a question we're asking, and how do you manage it? How do you kind of wrap your brain and your hands around time as a concept in order that you can keep it, which is the title of the podcast. And what that means is a little tricky, right? We have a certain amount of time in the day and on Earth. How do we make the most of it? And what are some, you know, kind of concrete ways that we can change our relationship with our work, our leisure life, our community, our family, in order to feel like we have a better handle on time?
It's funny because at first I thought, well, this would be about how to maximize your time. But then I look at this season's episodes and how to waste time, how to look busy, how to leave work time at work. And the one that it was just out on New Year's Day, how to rest. Interesting. And Becca, why is when you looked at the clock and our relationship to it, why is it so problematic for people?
I think it's challenging for most of us not only to just sort of balance the day-to-day to-do lists, you know, the juggling of all the responsibilities that people have, you know, parents with multiple jobs, with kids and chores. There's just sort of the busyness of day-to-day life. But then there's also the sort of planning for the long term, people's visions of a 5-year plan or a 10-year plan, or these ways that time is both short-term and has this long-term nature that we feel like we can never really keep up with. So our relationship with the clock is beyond just getting everything done in a timely manner, but also the ways that time allows us to change, the way that time influences who we are and sort of our concept of self as things change over time. So there's sort of this short-term and long-term nature with which we relate to the clock.
And I can relate to that. And one of the things you talk about in the podcast, Becca, is this social clock, as you call it. And how would you explain the social clock? And does this cause some of the anxiety we feel about time?
Definitely. And I think my obsession with the social clock theory, which was a concept developed by a social psychologist, Bernice Newgarten, in the 1960s, is all about these sort of time markers we have at different stages of life, you know, those big indicators of when our culture determines that things are appropriate to do. So let's say getting married in your late 20s or buying a house before you're 40, whatever those markers sort of are. And I think for me personally, realizing that I had missed some of those markers and that time was passing nonetheless is certainly one of those stressful measures of, you know, our time on Earth is limited, and did I do the most with it?
We're talking about time, how to manage it, make the most of it, even waste it, with our guests Becca Rashid and Ian Bogost. They're the co-hosts of the Atlantic podcast, How to Keep Time. And you both interviewed a variety of philosophers, experts who weigh in on the way people relate to time. One of them is Oliver Berkman, the author of 4,000 Weeks, Time Management for Mortals. And let's listen to him weighing in on the problem with all time management plans.
It's right. Defining everything about now in terms of some more important moment coming later when it's going to actually have its value. It's going to cash out, you know,
right.
It's going to have been worth doing.
Ian, what did you learn from Berkman's approach to never having enough time in this life?
Yeah, so one of the things that Berkman teaches us is that if your time is limited, which it is, and that 4,000 weeks idea that's the title of his book is his sort of calculation of the total number of weeks alive that the average person has in the developed world, which doesn't seem like a lot when you think about it that way. So if time is kind of always limited, then you can't do everything. You're going to have to give up on some of the things that you don't have time for or that you think you ought to have time for in order to make room for the ones that are not just the most important, but, you know, that feel like you want to partake of them. And so this idea of always looking forward in time that clip of Berkman mentions, that's one problem. That we're so used to thinking about doing things for some future investment, right? I'm going to learn something, not in order that I can enjoy it or be good at it or know how to do it or just be in the moment with it, but that I can have a side hustle based on this hobby that I didn't even let be a hobby or something like that. So learning to live in the moment that you're in, even as it's passing you by, and to take advantage of the time that you're in right now, rather than always thinking of it as an investment in the future, especially since often we make those investments poorly and do things that don't necessarily benefit us.
And as Berkman goes on to single out Americans and our relationship with time and how it's at least partly guided by capitalism, time is money, as the saying goes. But Becca, what advice does he have for breaking out of that time is money mindset that we have?
Yeah, I think that time is money mindset is definitely part of, for me at least, what feels like the compulsion to sort of pull my phone out at any moment when I'm waiting for the train to come in the morning, or, you know, maybe I can get ahead at work, or maybe I can get ahead on reading something, you know, this sort of compulsion we have to not just instrumentalize or sort of think about the future in every moment, as Ian mentioned, but also think that there's some future reward in investing in the now, you know, and that's so in such stark contrast to this message that we all hear to be in time or be in the moment. It's sort of impossible to do that and also be obsessed with making every moment productive, making sure that no minute is going to waste. And even if there's not a direct, you know, for-profit thing happening in the moment, knowing that maybe if I read that article or I get ahead on something in this minute, then there will be some payoff weeks into the future.
So what?
And
I'm just curious about how that ties into the focus of this season's How to Keep Time, and how you're looking at rest, and how you're looking at wasting time, and how you're looking at leaving work time actually at work. What made you decide to tackle these aspects of the way we tackle time?
Yeah, I think it's just sort of this. It's become so entangled in our behaviors, right? And I think that's why I give the compulsively pulling out the phone example. Sure, some may argue that's a smartphone addiction and that's something separate, but I think it's also just this inability to stand still. It's not just the inability to detangle from work or, you know, leaving work at the door or how to rest, all these other topics that we thought of. They're all related to that one moment of pause that we wish we had, but when we do have the moment to do it, we're not exactly comfortable, or we say we want to focus on one thing, but when we are watching a movie, we pull out our phone and we're texting someone else at the same time. So there's sort of this presence of mind issue as it relates to our time, but also these ways that we're conditioned to be multitasking all the time, to be doing multiple things at once. And though most of what we tackle in the series is about work time and about rest, you know, not everyone has that luxury as well. So we're trying to find ways to stop and think about why we do what we do with our time, and maybe from that begin to untangle, where are there moments for leisure? What does that look like for me? What does rest look like for me? And how can I begin to not only reclaim my time, but have a better sense of how I'm using it and begin to change that.
My time. That's what struck me there, is it's a possessive. This is my time. And the question then is, well, how am I going to use it? And how much time do we have? We're talking about time, how to manage it, make the most of it, even waste it. Becca Rashid, our guest, and Ian Bogos. They are the co-hosts of the Atlantic podcast, How to Keep Time, with their latest episode out on New Year's Day. And it's worth investigating. The conversation is yours as well. You can join us with your struggles with time or how you've solved the time conundrum in your life. Your time at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guests this morning are the co-hosts of the podcast, How to Keep Time, from The Atlantic Magazine. Becca Rashid and Ian Bogost are with us, and we're exploring our complicated relationship with the clock and what we can do to keep from feeling like we're constantly running up against it. Why is time so often our antagonist here? What would it take to make time itself an ally instead of, I don't know, an opponent? Answer the question, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. And let's hear some more from the How to Keep Time podcast as it explores how time is often a commodity or a status symbol. Our guest spoke to Neeru Paharia, a marketing professor at Arizona State University who studies busyness and what it signifies. Here's a little bit of what he said.
If you have very little time, then you in and of yourself are somewhat of a scarce resource. And then people might come to feel that you're more valuable or have more social status.
Ian, can you help explain how time can become a status symbol?
Yeah, so if you think about it, think about like the busy, important people in your life, in your work life, or you know, in your community, your church, your home life. It seems that they are completely booked, you know, and that having no time, being in demand, that is a way of declaring that you're important, of really being important, but also of sort of symbolically appearing important. And you might find yourself like, oh, you know, can I even approach my boss or my, you know, some leader in the community? I'm so sorry to bother you. I know you're really really busy. And so, you know, that's a relatively new thing. Like you go back 100 years or so, and if you were very important or wealthy or powerful, then you would have a lot more time to do what you want with. Now, as you know, kind of American capitalism has changed the way that we think about time and status, being unavailable is a way of kind of climbing the social ladder. And because of that sort of desire culturally that unavailability makes you important, all of us kind of want to feel or look or be busy all the time, which isn't necessarily helping anyone.
So one of the episodes of this season's How to Keep Time podcast, How to Look Busy. Becca, what's the value in looking busy? Is it just collateral status?
That's such a great question. I wish I knew the answer to that, but I've certainly probably pretended to be busy when I wasn't to get out of a social obligation. But I think why someone may be inclined to be busy or act busy, you know, those are sort of culturally dictated norms, as Ian said. It's something that we decide has social status based on what we value in American culture. And you know, that is not the same in every country around the world. So if time as this scarce resource that we give value to is important in an American context, because we believe that working hard and climbing the ladder, that's a way that people can elevate themselves in society. In an interesting study that Neeru Paharia shared in the episode, in countries like Italy, where social status is based on your family, let's say, the conventional sense of what gives you status in society is your family, your sort of family ties, and your ability to have actually more free time. So whereas here we see having more free time as not having, let's say, enough to work on, or you're not busy enough, and that lowers your social status. In other countries like Italy, where you have ample free time, you have more leisure, it's seen as, you know, you don't have to work as much, you maybe have more money, and hence you can leverage that free time and use it as you wish. So again, looking busy and making that sort of a social status symbol is very much an American phenomenon.
So as we throw out our 2023 calendars and get our new 2024 calendars, we're taking a step back to take a look and reflect on, well, time itself. And who better to do that than the hosts of the How to Keep Time podcast, our guests, Becca Rashid and Ian Bogost. We also want to invite you to the conversation to share your relationship with time at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where Linda in Milwaukee is standing by. Linda, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for addressing this very important topic. I'm a retired school teacher. I taught in a community college for almost 40 years, and I retired about 10 years ago when my husband passed away. And so I'm a widow, and I have a lot of time on my hands. And I do spend time working out at the gym. I take singing lessons, which is a passion of mine. I keep up my home. I try to stay connected to friends. And somehow I find a lack of purpose, and sometimes feeling as if I have too much time on my hands and not knowing what to do with that time.
Linda, I appreciate the perspective, and I would love to get responses from both our guests, Ian and Becca. I'll start with you. What about those who feel like, and I can relate, Linda, the times when I haven't been employed, or I feel like, I have all this time, I don't have anything else, though. So, Becca Rashid, have you taken a look at this, the too much time issue?
Yeah, Linda, thank you so much for sharing that perspective. And as you said, Lee, I can also relate to this feeling of what we've sort of found on the podcast to be sort of empty time, or this time that feels like, you know, time moves in all these weird ways. It's like too big at certain moments. It feels like there's too much of it. And then at other moments in life, it can feel like everything happens all at once. And I wish I had a better answer than, you know, that I'm still looking for the answer to that myself, when it feels like there are not enough activities to sort of fill the time. And that is something separate from busyness, or just sort of needing, you know, more tasks or to-do lists, as you outlined, Linda. You know, you're kind of doing everything, and it still feels like there is, you know, still that empty time, or that space, you know, the time starts to feel like space. And I know that's something during the pandemic as well. I definitely felt like there was so much sort of space and room to fill. And I sort of tried to develop more focus on, you know, certain hobbies and interests, but I understand the sentiment, Linda, and I don't want to say that I have it figured out whatsoever. I'm curious if Ian has some more advice.
Yeah, I mean, I really, really appreciate Linda's observation, you know, and one of the things that we tried to explore in the podcast this season is that time and our experience of time is very strongly related to our sort of anxiety about existing as mortals. Sorry to get like kind of, you know, heavy.
No,
so
but
early
that
in
seems
the morning.
To be close to the heart of it, doesn't it? That
yeah,
there's
yeah,
only
no,
so
it,
much
it
time.
There's only so much time, and we know that. But then at the same time can feel like it drags, or that we don't know what to do with it, or that the things that we're doing with time aren't the right ones. And you know, Linda's pointed out an experience that happens, you know, in retirement or later in life. And we did talk to a number of retirees as we were researching this sort of question of how people manage time, and their experience of time can be different than people who are working, you know, as professionals in the middle of their life, or younger people. And that sense of time dragging. Like, I remember, you know, like kids, time feels like it moves a lot slower when you're a kid.
Yes.
But also, you know, because children aren't in control of their lives and they don't get to decide what happens next to them, often there's a lot of empty time. And, you know, another theme that we explored on the show with respect to this is that the our smartphone lives, the fact that you can always pick up your phone and find something to look at no matter what it is, that's changed our familiarity with that sort of feeling of empty time. Like back before you had a smartphone in your pocket or purse, you would often find yourself with nothing to do. You would be alone with your thoughts. Mm-hmm. You're sitting waiting for the dentist or a bus or a train, or you're just kind of the next thing to happen during your day, your meal to come, all of those kinds of moments. We've now found a way to fill them with, not necessarily with important or useful information, although sometimes.
Oh yeah, but we've filled it with something, and we'll get back to the conversation. Sorry to cut you off, but we've got the news coming up. Ian Bogost, Becca Rashid, our guests. They are the co-hosts of the Atlantic Magazine's podcast, How to Keep Time. And we'll continue our conversation after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Perhaps it's worth pointing out here that time as we know it is still a relatively new concept. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, filling in for Kate Archer-Kent. And standardized time with time zones that span the globe actually wasn't formalized until the late 19th century. Legend has it that an engineer for Canadian Railways missed his train and, using the sun, couldn't figure out if he was late or the train left early. So this Canadian engineer decided to create a standard for clocks across North America and eventually the globe that would follow the sun and allow trains to run on time. But do any of us actually run on time? Maybe there's a better way than train schedules to help us understand and organize whatever time we have. With that, we reintroduce our guests. They are the hosts of the Atlantic Magazine's podcast, How to Keep Time, Becca Rashid and Ian Bogost. And Becca, one of the ways that people feel the most intense demands on their time has to be work. And you've got the episode, How to Leave Work Time at Work, this season. How does work affect the way we think about time?
Well, work is obviously where most of our time goes every day, and whether or not we like that, it's normally a challenge to detach from work time when we head home. And, you know, Ian shares this beautiful story in the episode about a coworker of his who every day on his commute home would sort of leave the office, have a book in his hand, and read on the train ride home. And I think a lot of us sort of fantasize about being able to mentally detach from work and come home and, you know, immediately start reading that book or, you know, be present for our families. But it's not that easy, right? Just because there are sort of psychological barriers to doing so. There's this concept of switching costs, which make it actually harder to sort of psychologically shift from task to task. You know, it's not easy to just leave work at the door and not be stressing about it on your way home. Or even if you're shifting between spending time with family and then needing to prepare dinner, there are all these sort of costs in sort of mental energy and time that we spend to actually be able to fully engage with the next task. But on top of that, leaving work time at work, we were actually moved by this video we saw of a young woman who was sort of sad on social media complaining about how her 9-to-5 job doesn't allow her to have a life, quote unquote, you know, after all the hours in the day. When is there time to make friends? When is there time to date? You know, all these other life concerns that people have. And though, you know, statistically, according to the CDC, people have about 5 hours of leisure time a day, it really doesn't feel like that. And whether that's because we can't psychologically detach from work when we get home, or, you know, it's the switching costs, there are all these barriers we have to actually being able to leave work time at work and come home and be able to enjoy our time in the way that we always sort of dream of.
But one of those barriers would have to be technology, right? Because work comes home with me and my phone. And Ian, we were talking about filling empty time with our cell phones before the news. But technology also seems to be one of these barriers.
Yeah, no, there's no question. And it was, you know, in the past, you would have to leave work at work because there's nothing you could do. Work was at the office. And, you know, maybe you could bring some papers home or whatever. And then we got laptops, then we got smartphones, and, you know, email pervaded everything. And now if you want, you can fill those empty spaces that we talked about before the break with work, even if it's just deleting emails, which I find myself doing a lot, which is, you know, that's useless a way to spend time. But I do it because it makes me feel like I'm getting something done. So we've allowed work, and, you know, allowed is maybe the wrong word. Work has infected our private time, but also our private time and our work time were never really separated in the way that we liked it. Like this idea that the work-life balance, or these two spheres of your work life and your life, and you're supposed to keep them separate, that has really never been possible because you are in your body and mind in the day, in your life, doing all the things that you're doing. It doesn't make any sense to think about them as separated and as things that you can then balance on a scale. And what that means is that in order to try to win back some of this time, try to keep some of this time, you have to change the way that you think about and operate in your work. Even something as simple, we talked to Nacho Sanchez Prado, professor of Latin American studies at Washington University, about like just the way that that having a different cultural perspective can help you get new ideas. Like one of the ideas he had is just, you know, spend 10 minutes an hour reading a book at your desk. Just take back some of that time. It doesn't have to be reading a book. That was his example. Mm-hmm. Take some of that time back for yourself because it's your time. It's not just your employer's time.
Oh, and Ian, well, I ask Becca, we were talking before about the different cultures, as Ian mentioned there, and how they compare to their relationships with time. As you mentioned in your podcast, in Europe and Latin America, people tend to linger longer for meals, enjoy time together. While if you've noticed, American restaurants tend to get you in, get you fed, and get you out so they can get the next folks in. What can Americans learn here, Becca, from other cultures about their relationships with time?
Yeah, I mean, everyone probably knows now, I feel like any reservation I make at a restaurant, there's like the 90-minute limit,
and
to get up and leave the table. And we were just having dinner the other night with my younger brother, and he said, you know, we've been at the table for almost an hour, we should, you know, give it up soon. So there are all these cultural norms we have around sort of rushing our mealtime, and not just mealtime, I mean everything else, feeling like we're wasting the next person's time, right? And I even share the story on the podcast how in my culture, in from Bangladeshi culture, my parents are from Bangladesh, we have sort of these tea rituals where the concept of wasting each other's time is kind of the point of tea time. It's to make tea and sit together. And it's not even to make conversation or to have really stimulating conversation. It's nothing like that. It's really just spending time in each other's company and sort of learning to not use that empty time. I don't want to use the word use or say that we're making it productive, but, you know, being together in these ways that we start to become comfortable with wasting that time, with letting time pass without beyond our control. And in that episode, our expert Ignacio Sanchez Prado that Ian mentioned, he brings up how they have this lunch ritual with coworkers, and sometimes those lunch rituals can go on, you know, to be as long as 2 hours, and something like that is unfathomable in American culture. Not just because, you know, we maybe don't have the time in the day to actually give to having that many hours of a lunch break, but normally the person you're eating lunch with is also conditioned to rush, right? So they're checking their phone, and you're both checking your clock and saying, we have to get back to our desks, we have to get to the next meeting. So even if you have the time, or that's something you desire to do, you need other people that are also willing to engage in that cultural practice with you. So I think that's where the challenge exists.
I think of all the people who eat lunch at their desk and just continue to do emails as they're eating over the lunch hour. Our guests, Becca Rashid and Ian Bogos, they are the hosts of the Atlantic podcast, How to Keep Time. And we invite you to the conversation. If you've got time management tools that you'd like to share, or if you've got stories to share about how you went up against time and came up a little bit short, don't we all? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. And Ian, are there strategies that you found that have been developed, others have developed, to keep work from encroaching on their personal lives and to keep the emails and lunch hours separate?
You know, there was this funny moment in the episode on work where Nacho, our guest, Becca asked, well, you know, so what, we asked the question you asked, what can you do? And he said, you know, you could just work less. And it was such a stark moment. But isn't that really the answer? We are in our heads so much about this stuff. And to some extent, we're not in control of it because, as Becca mentioned, it's kind of cultural. Like, you can't just kind of go, yeah, America now takes 2-hour lunches where we get together with our colleagues and our friends and commune. That's not something you can decide on your own. But you can put your work down. You can disconnect your email from your personal, your work email from your personal. There are things you can do. And maybe it's an oversimplification, or it feels like an oversimplification to say, well, just work less. But in some ways, that is the answer. So if you can find one way today of just working a little bit less, then that's, you know, 1% difference in your life tomorrow. And you can build on that as a kind of structure that can become a habit.
Becca Rashid, is there an app for that? I mean, can technology be helpful for managing time? Is going to my phone, is there something to be found in there to help with time?
If there is an app for that, I would love the recommendation, because I know my friends who do set alarm clocks for everything, and there are sort of habit management and habit maintenance apps, and I'm sure those are helpful. You know, maybe just having the reminder to take those 10 minutes before the start of every lunch hour on a weekday to read at your desk or whatever it may be. I think those would be extremely helpful, because as Ian just mentioned, a lot of this sort of compulsion or pressure to work is also performative in a way, right? Like that need to look like you're rushed or look like you're busy is also this thing that we feel like we have to show to others to appear a certain way, to appear like a certain kind of worker. And it's something interesting that another expert of ours, Melissa Masmanian, raised, that in an American context, those of us who are overworked or, you know, feel like we don't have enough hours in the day, they come from these cultural values we have to be a certain kind of adult. And those three sort of big things that we aspire to are to be, you know, number one, an ideal worker, number two, to be the perfect parent, and number three, to have the perfect body or sort of upkeep fitness goals. So there are these sort of big umbrella concepts we have of how we should be spending our time, what it should be going towards. And if the dreams or ambitions are sort of that big to upkeep those three very big sort of goals, I think you would need a time management app or something to almost count every hour of the day.
Becca Rashid and Ian Bogos joining us. They are the co-hosts of the Atlantic Magazine podcast, How to Keep Time. And we'll take your calls when we continue at 1-800-642-1234. Share your relationship with time. Share your tips about how you are able to find more time in your day. Or tell us the horror stories of how time got the better of you. I'm Lee Rayburn at 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. My, how time flies. It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn. How to Keep Time is the name of the podcast from the Atlantic Magazine, and we are rapidly running out of ours with our guests, the co-hosts of How to Keep Time, Becca Rashid and Ian Bogost. Still time for your calls and comments, however, at 1-800-642-1234 or emails at email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron and Oshkosh joins us next. Aaron, good morning.
Hey, yes, hello, good morning, everyone. Thank you for the call. I just wanted to recommend a pretty simple life philosophy. Claim all of your time
for
yourself.
That's yours.
It. Possess it. It's your life. It's your time.
Well, you know, Aaron, that sounds a little selfish.
Well, guess what? I didn't make the world. I'm living in it. I'm going to live it on my terms. And that means that if I have to get up and go to work, it's my choice to get up and go to work. There's nothing that can force me to do it. If you think otherwise, then you become a victim. Aaron, and you lose your power.
So hold on. Possess your time. Otherwise, you lose your power. Let's get reaction from our guests. And Becca, I'll start with you. Is it selfish to own your time?
I love that sentiment, Aaron. And I don't think it's selfish to own your time, of course, but I also think that we are social creatures, and it's normal to feel that, you know, I should be doing this or I should be doing that. You know, that social clock concept we talked about in the beginning of this hour, you know, what society thinks that we should be doing at different stages of our life. You know, there are also social pressures around how we should be using our time, or, you know, if busyness is a status symbol and how we indicate to other people that we're important. You know, there are all these weird ways that time and how we use it has become almost communal in a way. So even as much as we want it to be something that's just for us or just a part of our lives or be selfish with it, you know, there are often these needs that, you know, pull us towards obligations to children or family or work, and I think it's easier said than done, but I definitely aspire to that.
Yeah,
I aspire to be selfish with my time.
It sounds empowering. He's right. It seems mm-hmm. like taking the control back from the clock, if you will. And Ian, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't hear Aaron making a selfish claim, but it's like a reminder that that your time is the only time you get, but also that you are in time, and you can't stop it. This is going to be the subject of a forthcoming episode of the podcast, sort of the
how to stop time.
I wish we could stop time. The nature of time as a concept in the universe, right, rather than as a social or a cultural one. And one of the weird things about time is that it just seems to flow, and that means that thing that you're doing right now is the only way that you're going to spend the moment that you're in, which does mean that you need to be, you know, deliberate and aware of time's passage and the choices that you can make around how to make use of it. And yeah, of course, you know, you're going to run into social pressures, pressures of money and, you know, who's demanding your time and why. I would very much love to use all of my time in the way that I choose, but I also have to make a living so I can put a roof over my family's head. And in some of those senses, like, even if you could do whatever you wanted, that doesn't really solve the problem, right? Because you don't know what you want. And as Linda mentioned earlier in the hour, even when you do have more time, for example, in retirement, it's sometimes not 100% clear what you would
right.
do with the time available to you. So I think this is like a tug of war. It's a push and pull where you may win back a little bit of time. You may hold on to it for a moment, and then you realize, oh, well, now that I have it, I'm not really sure what to do. And you know, we will stumble forward bit by bit, hour by hour, and hopefully get a little bit better over the course of our lives and the months and years that pass at making sense of how to use time in a way that feels like more like it is yours, yeah. And that the thing that happened to you last hour, last year, was a thing that really happened, rather than just that you were kind of in the flow of this river of time, uncontrolled.
take control. We're reflecting on the passage of time and how we process it and how we possess it. Becca Rashid and Ian Bogost, our guests, they are hosts of the Atlantic podcast, How to Keep Time. And your most recent episode out on New Year's Day is How to Rest. And you interviewed Alex Pang, who studies and writes about rest. Let's hear a little bit from Alex about what he had to say about the work habits of Charles Darwin, the famous scientist who developed the theory of evolution.
Charles Darwin would work for a couple hours and then putter around in the garden, work some more, and then go on a long walk. What's important there is that it means that you are, in a sense, using two sets of creative muscles. There's your conscious mind, where you're working to solve problems, but then your unconscious is able to take over and continue thinking about things often in new ways and exploring new connections or avenues.
Ian, what's the takeaway from Charles Darwin's time management?
Yeah, so what Alex Pang, I think, was intending and using Darwin as an example is not just like be a famous scientist, right? Just be successful, and then, you know, and then your problems are all solved. But rather that the ability of Darwin and others to be creative, to see the world in new ways, to come up with novel ideas and approaches to whatever it is that their interests are, is driven in part by stepping back. And, you know, taking a walk, which is something that, that Pang recommends, generally speaking, this really works for me. You know, if I'm kind of stuck on something and I just put everything down and go outside and walk a little bit, I find that that gets the gears turning. So it doesn't have to be, you know, gardening or walking, just different things for different people. But the point is like taking a break, but not just sort of sitting around. It's not about like, I just need to work a little bit and then kind of, oh, finally, I can take a break and kind of slump into the couch and watch TV. That's not the idea. But structuring your effort such that you have these spaces in which the ideas and the work can kind of like percolate and work itself out and take form, that's not just that it's useful, it's that it's essential to the construction of new ideas.
And Becca, give us a look at the future. You sort of mentioned some of the one of the future episodes of How to Keep Time. What's on the horizon for you guys?
We, as Ian mentioned, we have sort of a time is weird and the wonkiness of time in the universe, which we are both still trying to figure out, I think. And also looking forward to the ways that we sort of feel pressured to hold on to time or the strange sort of behavioral habits we have to record everything in our lives. So whether that's journaling or taking photos, you know, there are all these ways that we want to hold on to special moments. We want to preserve memories in a certain way. And how does that help us have a better sort of narrative of who we are and make sense of our time on Earth, and how much of it is maybe a bad habit of trying to hold on to things that we ultimately can't keep forever. And, you know, the train of time just keeps moving. So that's some of what you can look forward to.
Just because the train of time keeps moving doesn't mean you can't, to some degree, at least own it, possess it, make it yours.
Yes, and make good choices around it, yes.
Yes, and that is goes to the heart of the podcast, How to Keep Time, with our guests, and now we're out of time. So thank you both for joining us. Becca, Ian, it's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Becca Rashid and Ian Bogost, the co-hosts of the Atlantic Magazine podcast, How to Keep Time. Check it out now. Ian's a contributing writer to the magazine. Becca is a producer of the podcast. And I thank them both for our time this morning. Thank you as well. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent today, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.